Thank you. Thank you very much, Richard. And yeah, I'll repeat my thanks to KPFA. Thanks to all of you for coming out, first of all, tonight. And yeah, I do have an important debt to KPFA because that's where I first learned to be a journalist and first learned to write and got my start. So the thesis of the book is, in a nutshell, that climate change doesn't just look like bad weather. It also looks like religious warfare, ethnic pogroms, insurgency, banditry, state repression. And what I try and do is trace the causality from the climate crisis into these political crises of violence. The idea for the book came to me when I was in Afghanistan, and I was actually under contract to write a different book about Afghanistan. And I was researching the opium trade, the heroin trade, and the poppy farming in Afghanistan. And I was asking the farmers, why do you grow this illegal crop and risk the punishment of the government and the NATO forces? And one part of their answer, again and again, in different parts of Afghanistan, over a course of years, doing a series of stories on this, was it's very drought resistant. And at first, I didn't even realize there was a drought in Afghanistan. Turns out there's the worst drought in living memory in Afghanistan has coincided with the whole US-led NATO occupation. And opium poppy uses one-fifth the amount of water that wheat uses. In this war, one side, the foreigners and the Afghan government, attack poppy. The other side, the Taliban, defend the farmers' right to grow poppy. So it occurred to me that along with the ethnic ideological motivations that would cause Pashtun young men, because the Taliban is an ethnic insurgency as well as a religious one, and it draws its support from the Pashtun of the southern parts of Afghanistan, along with ethnic ideology, along with religious ideas, there was this material incentive that would cause a young man to go fight for the Taliban, which is that is the side that defends his family's right to grow the only crop that's economically feasible in these drought conditions. And one can't blame any specific drought or any specific set of storms on climate change, but what we can say is there's a pattern that has been predicted by climate scientists for decades, and it is coming to fruition. And the correlations, as you all know, are burning fossil fuels leads to rising CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. This traps more heat. As the temperature rises, the climate system begins to unravel. Monsoons become irregular. They come all at once. They don't come when they should. The intertropical convergence zone, the main weather system that travels from the Tropic of Cancer to the Tropic of Capricorn, is pulled by the sun and regulates the rainy seasons in most of the tropics, is increasingly out of whack. And there's a general pattern of increased drought punctuated by extreme flooding, even though generally the atmosphere is, as it gets warmer, holding more water, it comes down all at once in sudden deluges. So the effect on the ground is drought. So I then set off to investigate other examples of how this would happen, how violence and climate change are connected. And it became clear that climate change doesn't work on its own. It arrives in the global south on a stage preset for crisis. And the forces in history that have preset the crisis in the global south are the militarism of the Cold War and particularly the hot proxy wars of the Cold War, which took place in the global south and have ripped the social fabric of many societies to pieces, undermined social solidarity, and left many places littered with cheap weaponry and lots of men who know how to assassinate and smuggle and torture and operate as either criminals or insurgents or police operatives. The other force that has primed the stage for crisis is economic restructuring, neoliberal economic restructuring, as promulgated and enforced by the World Bank and IMF since the late 1970s. And that has mandated the withdrawal of the state from the economy. And that's translated around the planet again and again into the privatization of state assets like utility companies and transportation companies and ports, cutting support to farmers and herders and fishermen in the forms of loan programs and regulated markets and government-supported cooperatives. And neoliberalism has produced increased poverty throughout the global south. Sometimes it's created increased growth rates. In India, for example, is growing rapidly, and that's associated with neoliberalism. But more often than not, it's been marked, its legacy has been economic stagnation and failure, even in its own terms, its stated terms of reviving these economies, getting them out of debt, causing innovation and growth and all of that. And along with increasing poverty, crucially, it has led to increased inequality. And inequality is important because deprivation, economic suffering alone doesn't necessarily cause political instability. Sociologists know that it's relative deprivation that causes political instability. And this could be political instability that one might support, like rebellion and organizing, or it can be political instability that one does not support, like banditry and jihad or criminality. But the thing about relative deprivation is that people tend to take extreme action when they feel that their poverty and suffering is wrong in relationship to what was, what could be, what should be, what is right, and inequality heightens that. So this is the social terrain into which now comes flooding, droughts, etc. The best way to unpack this dynamic, this combination of these forces, I call the catastrophic convergence, because it's not just climate change. It's climate change exacerbating these pre-existing crises, which is essentially the crisis of imperialism, the crisis created by imperialism. Yeah, the best way to illustrate this is to give you some examples and tell you some stories. So the book opens in Kenya. I went to Northwest Kenya and one day found myself looking down at a man who had been killed the afternoon before, named Ekuru Lorimon, and he was a Turkana pastoralist. And the Turkana live in the Rift Valley of Kenya, and they herd cattle and goats. And he had been killed in a raid when a neighboring group, the Pokot, had come down from the hills to try and steal his cattle, and there was a big gunfight involving 90 people, and 6 people died. And so I asked myself, why did this man die? In many ways, you could say, well, this is, you know, standard operating procedure there. The Nilotic tribes of the Rift Valley have been raiding each other's cattle for a long, long time. But what's changed recently is the intensity of these raids and also the weaponry that's used. They're now doing this with automatic weapons. It's happening with greater frequency and with greater violence and greater desperation. So why was that? The weapons, where do they come from? They're a legacy of the Cold War. The first wave of cheap machine guns into Kenya comes when Uganda momentarily collapses because Idi Amin has launched a war against Tanzania. And the armories on the border of Kenya are looted. The second big wave of weapons comes in when Somalia collapses. And Somalia is a tragic story that begins with the Cubans trying to build an alliance between two socialist revolutions, really socialist coups, one in Ethiopia, one in Somalia, supporting both of them. But the Somali dictator, Sayid Barre, was more than anything a Somali nationalist and wanted to be the father of Greater Somalia. And so he launches a covert war to regain a piece of Ethiopia, the Ogaden region, which is populated by Somali-speaking people. This war blows open. Sayid Barre switches sides. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan pour in support to his side. The Cubans and the Russians are there working with Ethiopia. Sayid Barre won't come to the table. He fights until his army collapses, and with it his government, and that is in January, the first days of January 1991. And there hasn't really been a real government there since. And the whole region has been flooded with guns that come out of Somalia. The other factor in how that cattle raid went down is the fact that there aren't enough water holes in that area. The landscape is extremely desiccated, and now we get reports of actual famine breaking out in northern Kenya, along the Somali border, and in Somalia. And when I was there, all of the grazed land was dry, the acacia trees were dead, and they looked like standing driftwood, and the Turkana women were in violation of Kenyan law, which was overlooked because there was nothing else for them to do, cutting down these trees and burning them into charcoal that they would then sell to passing trucks going in and out of Sudan. And the government, due to neoliberalism, has withdrawn all of its old supports. There's not as much veterinarian support for the pastoralists. There are no well drilling programs. There's no water harvesting program to try and build what they call tanks there and build underground dams to contain moisture. There's a whole technology of water harvesting, even in very extremely dry environments. And there's none of that is happening. And there aren't enough water holes because the government has withdrawn in the name of free market efficiency. The market is supposed to handle these problems. And so people like Ekuru Lohrmann and the Pequot who raided him are left to their own devices to adapt to this extreme climate in which their cattle are dying and they're cutting down their natural patrimony and selling it off. And what they fall back on are these weapons. And so you have a situation throughout the pastoralist corridor, which goes into from Ethiopia, Uganda, Somalia, Sudan, Ethiopia. There's a lot of, the violence has reached a point where it's essentially intercommunal warfare. It's no longer ritualized traditional cattle raiding. It's full-on ethnic combat between communities. And the military gets involved. The Ugandan military will sometimes attack Kenyan raiders and cross the border, bomb them with airplanes. The Kenyan police, the paramilitary police, who look like soldiers when you meet them and operate with helicopters and machine guns, respond. And there's a low-intensity conflict going on there that's undeclared. And the official numbers are that over 100 people have died in this intercommunal conflict just this year. And I suspect that that is a real underestimate because most of these deaths are not reported. So that's how this combination of forces can unfold in an underdeveloped economy where people live very close to the land and have very little margin of error economically. But even in more industrialized economies, one can see how quickly climate change can translate into violence. And there's probably no clearer case of that than Kyrgyzstan, and not a country that is particularly important to the US media, doesn't receive a lot of attention, small landlocked Central Asian country. But people might remember that in the spring of 2010, Kyrgyzstan did make news when the capital went up in flames and there was ethnic rioting between Uzbeks and Kyrgyz. One government fell, another government came in, that government requested that the Russians send in troops. The Russians very wisely declined. Eventually the situation stabilized. And the story just seemed to be, okay, well, you know, these people hate each other, ethnic groups do that around the world. But really, what the truth of the matter is that Kyrgyzstan is an economy that gets 90% of its electricity from hydroelectric power, particularly one large Soviet-built hydroelectric dam. And the same drought that has punished Afghanistan for 10 years has caused the water level in that main dam to drop to the lowest level ever recorded. That forced the government to start rationing power. The rationing of power meant that industry had to lay people off because there were rolling blackouts and bakeries, small factories couldn't operate. So increased unemployment. The more unemployment there is, the less consumer demand there is, and so on, more unemployment, more layoffs. Then on top of the power rationing and the drought comes an extremely brutal weather, extremely brutal winter, one of the harshest winters on record. Cattle herds, the Kyrgyz are traditionally cattle herders, and the Uzbeks lived in the valleys, and there was a kind of relationship between the Uzbeks and Kyrgyz that had to do with the migration up and down of the Kyrgyz cattle herds and the sharing of water resources. Those cattle just freeze to death, a lot of them, in the middle of the winter. Pipes in buildings are bursting open. Pensioners are just freezing to death. And industry, so there's more demand for power. Industry, and then more rationing. Industry lays off more people. And there are more and more angry, unemployed young men spending their time in casinos with no future, no education, no opportunities, drinking vodka, gambling, getting more and more angry. The president then decides he's going to re-engage a stalled privatization program. And Kyrgyzstan is one of the economies, one of the Central Asian economies that was most subject to structural adjustment. And it actually kind of stalled out because it was so brutal in its initial implementation. So the president decides he is going to re-engage this process of privatization, deregulation, and he wants to sell the utility system. And to make the assets more attractive, he doubles the tariffs that people pay for power, with a promise to double it again. And so that's early spring 2010. And at that point, people hit the streets, and they're protesting about the declining standard of living and the fact that there are no jobs for anyone. That protest is met by state repression. Things devolve into ethnic violence led by these lumpenized young men in different communities. And it appears that it's just this ethnic hatred. But really what there is beneath this ethnic violence is a profound economic crisis. And beneath that is a climatological environmental crisis. So that concatenation of causation appears in numerous places, and I fear will appear more frequently as time goes on. Another example that should be frightening in and of itself is India, because India is a crucial economy to the world economy. It's central to a whole region, and it's central to the whole world economy. And it receives more attention for these robust growth rates, the rise of a nouveau riche. It's minted, I think, 10 billionaires since it began liberalization in 1991. And your tech support calls to Dell Computer are answered there. But outside of urban India, there's another side to what's going on with liberalization, and that is increased immiseration in the countryside. And at the same time that that's happening, there's a drought that has been striking particularly the eastern side of the Indian coast that runs along the coastal, there's a mountain range along the coast called the Eastern Ghats, and then one along the western coast called the Western Ghats, and inside of that is the Deccan Plateau. And there's a Maoist insurgency in India known as the Naxalites, which is a collection of parties that have split and reunited numerous times over the years. It began in Darjeeling, the district of Darjeeling, named, the tea named for it, I think, rather than the other way around. And for a long time, the Naxalites were contained within West Bengal, more or less, where they began, in the northeastern part of India. But as this drought has intensified over the last 10 to 15 years, they have progressed down the coast. And they follow, and they call this the Red Corridor. And they also call it the Drought Corridor. Because the districts in which there is severe drought, soon there follows the Naxalites. And the situation that causes farmers to join the Naxalites isn't just a response to dry weather. It also has to do with the liberalization of the economy, once again. So this is the situation in Andhra Pradesh, where I was doing my research. The Green Revolution came to India in the late 1960s as a program supported by USAID and the Ford Foundation. The idea was to avert famine by introducing intensive capital and chemical intensive agriculture to grow foodstuffs at first. Those techniques were adopted by farmers and then applied also to cash crops, and they migrated into Andhra Pradesh from the coast and started growing cotton using these methods of chemical fertilizers, chemical pesticides, etc. The farmers in Andhra Pradesh who grow cotton are having a hard time because of this drought and no longer have the sort of semi-socialist supports that marked so much of Congress's rule in the post-war era in India. I mean, India was hardly eradicated poverty, but there was land reform, there were programs to support farmers. If you compare the political economic history of India to, say, Pakistan, it looks quite progressive. But after 1991, all of those kind of semi-socialist, Keynesian-inspired forms of state intervention into the capitalist economy to support demand and support indigenous industries are slowly pulled away. And so one of the main things that is missing is any kind of credit system. So the farmers go into debt. They borrow money from moneylenders. The moneylenders don't want the land as collateral, in part because of the environmental crisis. They want their collateral for the loans in the form of crops. The only crop they will lend money for is cotton, because that's the only crop that farmers can't steal. They can't eat it if there's a crisis. They have to sell it. So what's going on is the farmers are planting more and more cotton, going deeper and deeper into debt. The deeper in debt they go, the more they have to borrow money, the more cotton they have to grow, the more cotton there is, the less the price in this downward spiral. And thousands of farmers have committed suicide by drinking, in a horribly sort of macabre poetic statement, drinking the pesticides intended for the cotton is the way that people typically kill themselves when they're confronted with this situation. But farmers also commit political homicide, not just suicide, or commit themselves to committing political homicide. That is to say, they join the Naxalites and they join up with the war, because the Naxalites come along and they give an explanation and an opportunity, they say, and a promise of deliverance from this misery. So that's how, those are the mechanisms by which the Naxalites follow the drought. It's linked through this process of debt, and specifically around GMO cotton and its role in destabilizing the economy there. The response of the Indian state has been sort of classic counterinsurgency, in that it uses some carrot and some stick. But generally, they have applied violence, not in a Guatemalan fashion of, you know, scorched earth, but more surgically. Assassinating, detaining, torturing, jailing, trying, and very, very problematically, increasingly setting up private paramilitary forces, sometimes made up of ex-Naxalites who have been re-educated after detention. And this is a, you know, classic old feature of counterinsurgency that goes all the way back to the Plains Wars with Native American nations. And those forces, the Salvajutum, as they're known, are reminiscent of the paramilitaries in Colombia, and already very problematic, but will, I think, become a very destabilizing force in the future. The assumption of the military and the paramilitary police is that they control these guys, but they don't. These are lumpenized gangsters, criminals, traumatized veterans of this war, and they're out there on their own, and they may or may not be following some agenda. Whether or not one agrees with that agenda, the point is that what the state is doing inevitably is introducing bands of armed men and cheap weaponry into a society that is in trauma. So there's also examples of, I mean, this crisis doesn't just happen in the countryside. There can be tremendous displacement between the site of where climate change is taking hold and where the violence gets expressed. And the argument becomes more attenuated, but I think is still valid. An example of that would be, and to interrupt myself for a second, I mean, in none of these situations am I arguing that climate change is the primary cause, the only cause. I mean, Afghanistan, that war was not caused by climate change, but it's exacerbated by it. The Naxalite rebellion was not caused by climate change, but it's exacerbated by it. So in Brazil, there's a sort of paradigmatic example of Latin American megacities with very serious crime problems. And this came to my attention when there was essentially a rebellion by prisoners and gang members in São Paulo on Mother's Day in 2006 or 2007, I forget. And I remember reading this and being amazed and horrified. Prisoners were given furloughs on Mother's Day in Brazil. And that Mother's Day, in response to the removal of some gang leaders from the general population into something like the SHU, the maximum security units we have here, the gangs went to war on Mother's Day, and hundreds of them attacked police stations and had day-long firefights with the police. It was an insurgency, but there was no, I mean, and they were tactically, you know, sophisticated and bold, well-armed, but there were no demands, no agenda. It was all the components of an armed insurgency, but with none of the political content. So I became intrigued to see if there was, in fact, a climatological connection to this violence that is such a problem in the favelas of Rio and São Paulo. And sure enough, there is, to some extent, I would argue. The main site of migration from, the main place from which people move when headed to the cities is the northeast of Brazil. And this has been a traditional pattern. The northeast of Brazil is a semi-arid region. It's always had an extreme climate, but it's getting increasingly extreme. It's getting increasingly dry and punctuated by really crazy off-season flooding. And so more and more people are leaving the land. And when they arrive in the favelas, particularly the young men, find themselves with very little to do, in many cases, other than join up with these gangs. And the gangs, the main one in Rio is called the Red Command, Comando Vermelho. And it's sort of a tragic history that brings together, again, the Cold War and climate change to some extent. I mean, the Cold War and economic restructuring. Many of you will probably recall that there was an urban guerrilla insurgency in Brazil in the 1970s, and the current president of Brazil is a veteran of those struggles, and she was captured and tortured and survived, Dilma Rousseff, I'm mispronouncing her name, but so she comes out of this, and many people in the PT, Lula's party, which has kind of re-engaged a progressive social democratic agenda and really lifted a lot of people out of poverty and done good, you know, good work in Brazil over the last 5 years. But other parts of that movement didn't emerge from prison and continue with a progressive left agenda. Some parts of the armed underground mixed with the general population tried to organize the prisoners into a guerrilla army called the Red Command, then moved out into the favelas, and at first wanted to tax the drug trade to control it, to raise money for the revolution. But as is so often the case, it didn't work that way. The drug trade came to inhabit the movement, and before long, by the end of the 1990s, the Red Command had lost any politics, and it was just an extremely well-organized, disciplined narco force. And it now is the de facto state in many of these communities, and it metes out punishment to, you know, the people in the community in an incredibly despotic, authoritarian way. In one case, when I was in Brazil, a 14-year-old girl had stolen somebody's cell phone, and so the Comando Vermelho, it's the Red Command, decided that her punishment would be shoot her through both hands. So that's the kind of thing that happens. You're caught shoplifting, shoot your knees, shoot you through the hands. More often than not, they just execute people. And the police go into these favelas. They're hardly ever there, but when they go in platoon-sized operations with machine guns backed up by helicopters. The Red Command had shot down a police helicopter. I rode with the police in a helicopter that had been hit by bullets. They were proud to point that out. And so you have this extremely serious crisis of violence that, to some extent, has its roots in the countryside. There has to be a solution to the rural agricultural crisis to help staunch the flow of desperate young men who are willing to do whatever it is the narco gangs require for them to make some money and have some respect and adventure in life. So I went up to the northeast of Brazil and to look at the situation there, and now the story gets a little more hopeful. There are some positive things happening, and in particular, I hooked up with the MST, Movimento Sem Terra, the landless peasants movement that has had great success over the last 20 years using direct action to occupy land, to redistribute it to poor farmers. And they're also now increasingly using new farming methods and moving away from chemical-based agriculture, which is good for the land, but is also, when it finally gets up and running, good for the farmers because they can de-link from the credit system, which can otherwise be a morass from which they can never escape because they don't need inputs like fertilizers and pesticides, which require money, etc. So in this one village, there was, on one side of the road, this community owned the land. They had title to it, and they had been, for 5 years, using this agroecological forestry method that they simply called the system, and involved mixing crops, trees and vine crops, using, you know, low-tech drip irrigation, like little plastic water bottles tied to the trunk of a tree so that the water goes just to that plant. There's all sorts of ingenious, really low-tech water harvesting techniques, like building underground dams. So when you have a wash or an arroyo where water would come down during the few brief moments of rain that this region would have, typically a lot of the moisture is in the soil and washes away quickly. So they'll find areas like that and then dig a trench down to bedrock, which is about sometimes 10 or 15 feet down there, and then build a sealed wall of cement and bricks lined with plastic. And they basically then fill this trench back in, and there's an underground dam, and it doesn't have behind it actual water, but it has behind it wet soil, and then that's where they farm. And it's very simple, but it works really, really well. The other side of the road, where they were occupying land that belonged to an Italian cattle rancher who was not there and was not using the land particularly that much. So they were, I hung out with them for a couple of days, and at first they were, you know, they were talking up the system, but then I realized that they were using a different technique on the other side of the road. They were clearing the land, planting monocrops, using chemicals. They've been, you know, spent all this time talking about the importance of trees and these different trees and showing me all these techniques. And then one day I found them cutting down trees. I was like, what's this about? And they kind of, you know, felt embarrassed about this, but they explained, look, you know, we don't own this land. The cops could come and crack our heads open and kick us out of here at any time. If this property is redistributed to us from this rich guy, then we will have the security we need to use the system, which takes 5 years to become profitable. And until then, we can't take the risk of working this land, nurturing it, knowing that we could be thrown off at any time. We have to make a little money to make this occupation worthwhile. So, I mean, that's a perfect encapsulation of how adaptation to climate change is not merely a technical issue. It's not merely about building seawalls to protect against rising seas or coming up with new technologies for farming in extreme climates. It's also about changing social relations, specifically redistributing power and wealth to the poor so they have some security to be good stewards of the natural environment. And there are a lot of boutique, somewhat marginalized boutique projects like this throughout the Global South, and as a progressive journalist, one can find them and often we, I think, are guilty of sort of inflating them into more than they are. Really what needs to happen is they need to be moved to the center of state policy. And one of the problems, one of the criticisms I would have of Lula's, otherwise I think very, very effective, very good governance, was that the reconciliation with nature has not been central to state policy. Redistribution of land, creating jobs, that's definitely on the agenda, but not an engagement with this equation between social justice and ecological adaptation. So, if climate change, as I'm arguing, creates violence in the global south, weakens states, pushes some states into relative state failure, I mean, that's kind of what you have in northern Kenya is relative state failure, and triggers religious war and ethnic conflict. What does it do in the north? And in the north, it is, I think, already beginning to help animate the incipient police state that we have in this country and to some extent in Europe, and I've written about this in other books. And the central issue, I think, domestically is migration. And the right is increasingly While they deny climate change, some elements of them don't. The mainstream of the right denies climate change, but some elements of the right don't. And they're articulating a xenophobic agenda of authoritarian anti-immigrant repression in terms of the aesthetics of the lifeboat. FAIR, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, the kind of right-wing, xenophobic anti-immigrant group that Garrett Hardin actually was a founding member of, has actually created a front group called Progressives for Immigration Reform. And they're at the forefront of articulating this kind of conservation through border militarization as a model. And you have a lot of people on talk radio who I cite in the book who call themselves conservationists and then use that as a justification to keep people out and blame. And they use a lot of environmental arguments. They say, yes, the carrying capacity, the footprint, you know, of this society is has reached its limit, and we therefore can't allow any more people in here. And the immigrants who are here need to be identified, rounded up, jailed, punished, deported, treated as second-class citizens. One of them, Deborah Walker, who's from Northern California, actually, she calls herself an environmentalist, and is it's, you know, I mean, I don't know what else to call her if you read some of these quotes other than just a staunch racist. So that's one way that wealthy economies are affected by violence that has some root in climate change. I mean, obviously, I'm not arguing that border militarization is caused by climate change. Border militarization begins in the early 90s in earnest, and it has many other causes, but increasingly this is an important contributing factor. Andrew Ross has a book coming out about Phoenix called Bird on Fire, and he gets into how clearly people think about the environmental crisis in Phoenix, and they don't always think about it in progressive ways. So, in other words, climate violence in the North is generally expressed as repression or an increase of the authoritarian project of surveillance, incarceration, militarized policing. The other response, the other way that it creates violence, is through the military's planning for what's going on. To the credit of the military, the Pentagon, the armed services, they take the science of climate change very seriously. They don't doubt the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the veracity of its fourth assessment report, the findings of the scientific consensus, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, as most of you, I'm sure, know, is the main clearinghouse, the UN's clearinghouse, where governments and scientists and industry come to a consensus on what the prevailing understanding of climate science is, and try and digest it in a form that will help policymakers respond. And it is not a radical organization at all, because industry, you know, the fossil fuel industry gets a vote in these negotiations. So the pattern has been that the IPCC is usually revising up its warnings. The House leadership, the GOP House leadership, of course, total denial of this. Even some Democrats, total denial. They think that the vast consensus among scientists is a hoax. The military, they don't agree. And they are planning for a future in which they see not so much an increase in conventional warfare between states over resources, though they imagine that could happen as well, but more likely increased instability, internal conflict, mass migration triggering ethnic conflict, religious warfare, insurgencies, religious and ethnic insurgencies, state collapse, humanitarian disasters, and they realize the armed services are going to be called upon to respond to this. And so what they have developed is a conception of the future as open-ended counterinsurgency on a global scale for the foreseeable future. And to read these reports, many of which are not classified and on the internet, is pretty harrowing. And, you know, they are not, also to their credit, they do not maintain that military methods alone can manage this crisis. These reports generally end with something along the lines of, if there isn't radical reduction in carbon emissions, any kind of adaptation, even this armed adaptation we're preparing for, ultimately won't work because this, the unraveling of the climate system will become self-fueling. There'll be positive feedback loops will be set off, positive feedback loops having negative consequences. For example, the Earth heats up due to CO2 emissions, the permafrost melts, methane gas is released. Methane is a greenhouse gas 20 times more powerful than CO2, so that then compounds the original cause. That's a positive feedback loop. And we're at the point where those are beginning. And climate science is very clear that once you've crossed the threshold of 350 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere, these processes get unleashed. And so it's, and we're now at 390 parts per million. And it wasn't until the mid-90s that they had final definitive confirmation of this, but that's when it was, I think it was 94, they finally got the first ice core out of Greenland, and they then had an extremely accurate record due to the air bubbles in this ice core of the last 10,000 years of the climate. And they discovered a couple things. One was that throughout most of that time, the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere had hovered at around 280 parts per million. And then with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, that begins to go up. And we're now at 390 parts per million and increasing rapidly. The other thing that they discovered from those ice cores was that the climate system doesn't change in a slow, linear fashion. What happens is that causes build up and the effects lag and then kick in all at once. And this was, in the early 80s, this was a kind of fringe position among climate scientists. I forget the name of the scientists who theorized this, and it seemed sort of crazy that the climate could switch. There'd be like a switch in climate regimes. But once they analyzed these ice cores, they saw, in fact, that was what happens. These sudden changes in the matter, you know, not in the matter of 300 or 400 or 500 years, but in a matter of 30 years, a whole climate regime could change. So we're at a point right now where that type of a shift is threatened, and we need to, as a result, really, you know, address mitigation, which is to say we have to cut our carbon emissions. So now the good news, if there is any. So the task at hand is both adaptation, which is, you know, technological and social, building social relations that can allow people to embrace new technologies that can help societies be resilient enough to deal with the extreme weather and produce enough food and share it enough to avoid social calamity and war. Social and technical adaptation, and then mitigation is cutting emissions. And there are some on the left who see mitigation as unimportant. There's a type of catastrophism on the left, some elements of the left, that almost welcomes the idea of a civilizational collapse because it's seen as a civilizational transformation. But I dissent from that view quite strongly. I think that it's unrealistic to think that if this society crumbles into chaos, that there's going to be much room for progressive social change if the climate system is spinning out of control and getting worse and worse and worse. So what that means is we have to get capitalism, which is the culprit in all of this, to come up with technical solutions to the climate crisis. This is not the same as solving all environmental crises. And I think that's another thing that happens sometimes when we think about climate change. Because of its magnitude, it can get conflated with all the other environmental crises. I mean, there's, you know, deforestation, the overfishing of the seas, soil depletion, all of these problems that will exist even if the climate crisis is solved. And, I mean, one does not have to abandon the position that capitalism is irreconcilably in conflict with nature to also hold the position that capitalism actually has to switch from fossil fuels to clean technology, or we're going to shoot right past 390 parts per million, right past 450 parts per million, onto who knows what, and the whole climate system will unravel. Marx and Engels were the first, you know, who actually theorized a kind of catastrophic conflict between nature and capitalism. They, relying on the work of Justus von Liebig, the father of soil chemistry. Would you like a sip of water?
Okay.
Okay, then no more water for you. So relying on the work of the father of soil chemistry, Justus von Liebig, who he talked about the problem of, he tried to understand why soil was depleting, and it was basically because food and clothing was taken from the countryside, consumed in cities, and then flushed down the rivers, and not, its elements, its constituent elements, not returned to the soil. So wool, flax, meat, vegetables, taken to cities, dumped down the Thames. And so Marx and Engels expanded this into a larger problem, and not just the problem, the contradiction between the countryside and town, but the contradiction between capitalism, a system that can grow infinitely, potentially, and the earth, which is finite. So there may, in fact, be a metabolic rift that is irreconcilable, but capitalism also has, as a social system, not capitalism as market mechanisms and policy tricks, but capitalist societies, through the socialistic elements of state planning and guidance and control of private wealth, has managed to solve some or mitigate, to some extent, previous environmental crises. The scale is completely different, but consider the crisis in urban America in the 19th century. There was waves of disease that actually, you know, got so bad that even the rich, though they could avoid it, couldn't avoid it completely, and epidemics would kill them as well. And it was in response to that local environmental crisis that was a basic problem of sanitation that the progressive movement and good government types started planning cities and started intervening and basically solved a local environmental crisis. We've also seen the air cleaned up, the water cleaned up, due to government intervention, regulation of industry. Those are not adequate solutions. They don't solve the problem. But it is possible to change specific pieces of this larger problem without thinking that we have to only change the whole thing before any one constituent piece can be addressed. And I think it's important for us to see the climate crisis in that regard, that if there is a solution to the climate crisis, that's not the same as reconciling with nature and having a completely sustainable society. What it is just buying time to stave off what could be catastrophic and abrupt climate change. So that's sort of an uncomfortable position, I think, for some people on the left, to have to think about what kind of policies are going to make this economy, because this is the thing. I mean, we have a few decades, so I really don't think we can create a new society in that time. So it's this society that has to address this with new technologies, and that means, you know, confronting the fossil fuel industries. And so, to wrap up, there are some things that can happen, even in this country, even with this, you know, insane proliferation of climate denialism that we're seeing. In other words, without getting the Republicans to embrace climate legislation, without cutting deals, these are some things that can happen immediately. The EPA has the obligation to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. Activists sued and fought for 10 years to force this through. And it, finally, in 2007, the Supreme Court agreed, yes, the EPA has the obligation under the Clean Air Act of 1970 to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. George Bush just ignored this. They said, okay, well, whatever. Obama has promised to follow the law. And we're waiting for rules. The first set of rules came down that regulated greenhouse gas emissions through the EPA nationally on vehicle emissions. But we're waiting for smokestacks, the tailoring rules for smokestacks to come down. And there's been delay and delay and delay. But if those rules are robust enough, and this doesn't require getting John Boehner or anyone else on board. If those rules are robust enough, that is the equivalent of a de facto carbon tax. And a lot of liberals would shy away from using those words, but that is what we want. We want a carbon tax. But because taxes and the EPA as bad guys is a right-wing talking point, a lot of professional environmentalists shy away from it. But really what could happen is EPA regulations could essentially close down lots of coal plants because they're too dirty. The way it would work would be that the plants could actually operate if they wanted to, but they would just have to pay these fines, and that would be the de facto carbon tax. So they would be shut down, and new investment would be channeled into cleaner technology, clean tech, like windmills and solar power and hydrokinetics and tidal power and all that sort of stuff. The other thing that could be done right now is the government could use its purchasing power to cut its emissions and jumpstart the clean tech sector. The federal government and state governments, if you combine their economic activity, are more than one-third of the U.S. GDP. This is another thing that many progressives and liberals don't articulate because, again, it's a right-wing talking point. And the right is accusing the Obama administration, which is in no way socialistic, of being socialist. So then people, you know, they don't want to say, yeah, actually, you know, the U.S. does sort of have a mixed economy. More than one-third of economic activity is the public sector. What could we do with that? And what we could do with that is if, you know, the federal government has the largest fleet of vehicles, largest fleet of buildings, is the largest energy consumer in the economy. If it committed itself to purchasing clean tech, clean power, come up with a schedule for bringing online wind farms and solar farms so that the federal government would be the market and it could shift completely to clean tech, if it, whenever possible, bought only electric vehicles and built an infrastructure for charging them, at first, of course, there'd be, you know, long-haul vehicles that the post office uses that would have to remain diesel or gasoline because battery technology wouldn't be there. But if the majority of the post office's vehicles, which is 140 vehicles, were moved to electric, that would be good in and of itself. If all the buildings were retrofitted, the federal government owns 450,000 mostly really, really large office buildings. If they were all retrofitted so that they reduced their energy consumption and retrofitted possibly, or the new ones built so that they could actually produce more power than they consume, that would be good in and of itself. But what all these things would do would also have the knock-on effect of creating economies of scale for the clean tech sector, which is currently stalled out and doesn't have markets. We have one little startup battery company, vehicle battery company in this country that got like a $30 million grant or loan from the federal government. Most batteries are made in South Korea and Japan and China. There's one firm that retrofits, that basically builds electric trucks. And if they had orders, they currently, I interviewed the CEO a couple times, and you know, they're currently, they get orders of one, two, three trucks here and there. If they got orders of, you know, 100 trucks every X amount of months for the next 5 years, they could buy all of their components in bulk. And that alone, the CEO told me, would probably reduce their costs by between about 25%, I think is what he said. Once electric vehicles and clean power become competitive with fossil fuels and energy from fossil fuel-driven vehicles and energy from dirty coal, then the private sector can switch over because it will make economic sense. So I'm not laying out to you my ideal version of society or social change, but I'm just trying to be adult about the situation we're in. And it sounds crazy, I know, because it's so beautiful and, you know, there are freak storms, but the climate system seems to be working mostly. But we know that the effects lag the causes, and abrupt climate change is a real possibility. And so we have to act on that knowledge. So I'm not describing what I think is the ideal future. It's just a realistic response given what we have, given the political situation, given the technical situation, and I think it's actually doable. I mean, and also, you know, another heartening fact in all this is there's tons of money to do this, right? I mean, corporate America is sitting on $1.8 trillion of uninvested cash. It has more cash on hand than at any time since 1956, according to the Federal Reserve. That money is looking for, yes, labor to exploit and nature to transform, but it's not going anywhere because the economy is stalled out. If there was this push to clean tech, there would be plenty of money from the private sector going into this stuff. So that doesn't solve all the problems of the metabolic rift. That doesn't reconcile humanity and nature. That doesn't solve the problem of exploitation and inequality. But those are some realistic things that could happen right now under these conditions to address this problem. So on that note, hopeful note, I will open it to your questions or pass the mic back to Richard.
Looking at the questions here, because this is an interesting group of people, so let me start by, there's one question here which just stuck in my mind, because I think it comes down to everything you just said. Let me rephrase it slightly. Given the resistance to ending fossil fuel consumption in the U.S. and the increase in greenhouse gas production, I guess in, I don't know what, BRIC countries.
BRIC countries.
Yeah. Now, okay. And that we are approaching or have already passed the tipping point. How do you imagine we will acquire the political will and power to avoid disaster?
Well, by reading my book, no. or at least buying it. That's a very tough question. I think, I mean, how I have no, expertise on how social movements should organize better than they do. But I mean, one thing I would say is that it's essential for organized labor to engage the climate issue, and it's essential for the organized labor, which unfortunately is fighting defensive battles and, you know, really battered, to basically be renovated. You know, I mean, there is no hope for the American left if organized labor isn't reinvigorated and politically renovated and starts being more aggressive tactically, investing in organizing and taking ideas seriously. And, you know, Richard Trumka, head of the AFL-CIO, I mean, his big climate initiative recently was to champion taking China to the WTO for subsidizing its clean tech sector, saying, oh, we, you know, American competitiveness is suffering because they're subsidizing their clean tech sector. We should stop them through the WTO. That was what he brought to the Obama administration, and the Obama administration initiated that. Not the opposite, not saying, hey, China is subsidizing their clean tech sector and look how it's growing. We need more subsidies. We need a second stimulus, and it needs to be around clean investment. So, I mean, those kinds of problems need to change.
Yeah, there are three questions that are more ideological, and I'm going to throw them all out more or less in order, and you'll see the connection. First is, you kind of dealt with, but I want to, this is an important point. It's a question about ideology, because if you're saying, this question is, can climate change be fundamentally addressed under capitalism? I mean, if there's no more world, what difference does it make what ideology is there, I guess? But on the other hand, if it can't be addressed, there is no more world.
Right. Well, I mean, what I'm arguing is that, I mean, I don't know, can it be addressed? Hopefully, yes. And what I'm arguing is that I think realistically, if we're grown up about it, and if we're willing to offend others' political sensibilities and maybe our own preconceived notions, there's no other choice. I mean, otherwise, I mean, you got to explain how there is a whole new society developed that then deals with climate change in the next 10 or 20 years. I mean, I just don't think that's at all realistic. I mean, can capitalism deal with it? That might not be realistic either, but to me it seems more realistic
Well, then the next part is, if capitalism and socialism are reliant on resource depletion, and resource depletion drives both economies, what do we do then? I mean,
well,
it's the same
thing, I guess. I mean, that's not a question I'm dealing with, and that's a very valid, important question. I mean, the socialist governments we have now are dependent on petroleum. Venezuela, Bolivia, I mean, it's a serious problem. I don't have an answer to it. But it is also, in my defense, not really what the book is about. The book is about climate change and not how socialist development could reconcile with nature. And, that's an important question. I don't really have an answer for that because that would require a specific set of investigations.
And these are questions that interest people here specifically. One is, what can we as individuals or as a local community do to change some of the dynamics, social, economic, climatological, that you talked about?
Well, I think that there's very little that anyone can do as an individual. But each individual can participate in social movements, and that's essential. We have to build social movements. We have to build institutional power to come together collectively to address these problems, to demand the changes that need to be made. And, I mean, that was the real tragedy of Al Gore's movie, which was had a really broad impact in this society and really brought this issue to people's attention, and then in the end he said go buy fluorescent light bulbs instead of incandescent light bulbs, and it returned to this methodological individualism that, you know, through consuming correctly, individuals can make politics and policy, and that's just not how politics happens. Politics happens when people act collectively. So it's great if you drive a Prius, if you cut your carbon emissions, but that is not, I think, a theory of social change. That is not how social change has happened in the past. So we have to build movements, which is to say institutional power, and there's a lot of that going on. I mean, in particular, there are fights around mountaintop removal. The Sierra Club and Greenpeace and Rainforest Action Network have been working with local groups in Appalachia to use a combination of methods ranging from direct action to sort of legal monkey wrenching to lobbying to shut down coal plants and coal mining. And over 100 plants in this campaign that were scheduled to come online have been abandoned. And it frequently, this combination of tactics ultimately just raises the political and financial cost of building a coal plant. And so then the investors back away and they back out. And so that's a movement that's happening now and is having victories. You know, and at the thin end of the spear are young people in tripods getting arrested, you know, sitting on these mountains, refusing to let them be blown up and mined for coal. Another big fight that's brewing is the Canadian tar sands, which are this, you know, filthy source of oil, are now economically feasible. Because as long as oil is above $85 a barrel, the financing works out to refine, to mine, extract, and refine this oil. And one path to the world economy is potentially a pipeline through the center of the U.S. down to the Gulf. And there's a fight that Bill McKibben and Naomi Klein and others have called for action around that pipeline in August in D.C. And people should Google tar sands. I think it's Tar Sands Action is the website. If that pipeline can be blocked, that raises the cost. That pushes back against the tar sands development. And if the tar sands are developed, the amount of CO2 they would release will really push us over the edge. So that is coal, fighting coal, and fighting the tar sands are some of the most important things American activists can do, North American activists can do right now.
The next question, you know, I keep thinking of Gorbadal's statement that America has one political party with two right wings. Can we work for reform within the Democratic Party? I mean, this is a question that a lot of people have. I mean, you know, if you don't work within it, then you're in the cold. If you do work within it, it's corrupted.
Well, I don't know. I just outlined ways of working that are not within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, okay.
And I think probably the best way to reform the Democratic Party would be to cause problems for the whole political system outside of it through, you know, the campaign against coal, the campaign against the tar sands. That's what's going to concentrate the minds of leaders in the Democratic Party and get them to take on these issues, not appealing to them directly or communicating with them directly. I mean, the first 2 years of the Obama administration were a really tragic time for the whole climate issue. I mean, we had there was this campaign to pass comprehensive climate legislation, which was really unnecessary because the EPA has this power. This is a point that the Center for Biological Diversity makes, and they've done great work in using the original environmental laws, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, to essentially legally monkey wrench development of all sorts. And I hesitate to say this on something that can be broadcast on the radio, but I will, I mean, because I think it recommends them. The Center for Biological Diversity are kind of like your right-wing uncle's stereotype of environmentalists. Like, they shut down a whole project just for a little weed or, you know, a little bug. And it's true, and it's very effective. And they've had like 90-something percent success rate in pushing back using the Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. Anyway, but so what happened instead of really engaging robustly these existing laws, the green organizations, particularly the big green organizations, the EDF and NRDC, got sucked into this DC vortex around trying to pass Waxman-Markey and the equivalent, the Carrie Lieberman-Graham Act through the Senate, which would have stripped the EPA of its power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And according to a good friend of mine, Ryan Grimm, who's the congressional editor at the Huffington Post, more than $1 billion somehow went into this project of just, you know, wasting time and money and resources on legislation that failed, and if it had succeeded, would have been totally inadequate. So, you know, that's an example of how not to try and engage with the Democrats. You know, they'll respond. If there's enough pressure outside, they'll come to you.
There's a series of questions here that I'm not going to go into specifically, but they seem to deal with levels of corruption between scientists and corporations, the possibility of conspiracy to destroy the climate. I mean, are these things that we should be thinking about seriously, or are they kind of beside the point?
I don't think there's a conspiracy to destroy the climate. There's an industry that has billions of dollars of fixed capital, which does that, sunk capital that destroys the climate, and that's the fossil fuel industry, and it's trying to defend itself through massive investments in messaging and lobbying. And, you know, there's like four fossil fuel lobbyists for every member of the Senate. This is a stat from Al Gore's recent article in Rolling Stone. Yeah, and the Koch brothers, who are now infamous and well-known names, you know, that was Greenpeace actually deserves credit for making them a household name. They had a whole dossier that they put on their website, and it was Jane Mayer's article in The New Yorker that really triggered everyone's understanding of this, and they've been outed. And they're followers of the Austrian economist Hayek, and the Hayekian project is at the heart of the whole revival of the hard right since the 1970s. Just as a little caveat, I mean, and yeah, so Hayek, you know, in the 1930s, convened a group of people who later become the Mont-Pelerin Society, and he wrote an article called Socialism and the Intellectuals, in which he argued that what he called liberals, by which he meant free traders, should imitate the left. And he said, look what the left has done. This creeping collectivism, by which he meant socialism, he also meant Mussolini's fascism, which involved corporatist cooperation between the state and business in a regulated fashion that he didn't like, and most threatening the New Deal in the core of the capitalist economy, the U.S. And he said, you know, the left has won the battle for ideas by waging a generation-long fight in which they kept asserting their core principles and were willing to lose specific battles, but to keep trying to reframe the debate. And he said that's what liberals, by which he meant the right, free marketeers, have to do. And out of that comes the Montpellier Society after the war and the rise of the right-wing think tank movement, the American Enterprise Institute, Heritage. All of those groups, those think tanks, are linked back to Hayek and his ideas and the people he convened. And the Koch brothers' father was a follower of Hayek, and that's very much the theory that they're operating with. And they invest heavily in ideas and messaging, and they're in it for the long haul. And ExxonMobil has also invested millions and millions of dollars over the last 20 years. I think it's over $20 million. And they, in promoting a free market agenda that has at the center of it this denial of climate science, ExxonMobil was even formally requested to not do this by the Royal Society, which is the main scientific body in the UK. And Exxon said, oh, we won't do that, sorry. And then continued to do it and were called out again by the Royal Society. And they said, oh, well, we're sorry. And this continues. So that's the nature of this campaign to defend the infrastructure that is destroying the climate.
And then the next question is, okay, how do we as individuals or collectively change the conversation?
Well, we do it collectively, and I don't know. Again, buy my book, I guess. No, I shouldn't joke like that. How do we change the conversation? I think in part by keeping an eye on the long term and realizing that the right has been effective by articulating ideas, not just information, not just spinning specific stories, but principles. I mean, you watch Fox News, they're always reasserting core principles. And so that's one way that the debate can be changed, is if in all these specific fights and in all these specific investigations, we also are clear about the legitimacy of the role of government in the economy. That government is not a bad thing. Yes, it has armies and police states as well, but that's not its core essence, not the only function of government, that there is a legitimate role for government to protect the freedom of people who don't have economic power and to create a space for people who otherwise would be crushed by wealth and market forces. And, to continually articulate basically, you know, a core progressive message to move towards a mixed economy and that it's legitimate to control private wealth and regulate the economy.
Cap and trade.
Crap and trade, as some call it. That's what that whole Waxman, Markey, Carrie Lieberman, Graham stuff was about. And it failed.
Here's a question.
But one thing I would say, just abstractly, the operative word, of course, is cap. Right? I mean, I don't think this is going to happen. I think it's sort of a dead end. But if there were some system whereby there was real severe caps and there was some trading, okay, well, whatever, there's trading. But the key operative word in that is cap. And the problem was that there wasn't much of that on offer in that legislation anyway.
There's a question here about China and its use of coal, and I keep thinking also about India and the Enron dams, and that brings us back to your book and the struggle over Kashmir, which is a struggle over water between Pakistan and India. We're here in the States. There's a big world out there, you know. What do we do if we manage to get things together here on some level and the rest of the world falls apart?
Well, if the U.S. government took this issue seriously, the rest of the world would be ready to embrace the process and go along. And that's the great tragedy of the Obama administration, is that in the run-up to Copenhagen, when there was the Kyoto Protocol, which was an agreement to limit greenhouse gas emissions, which was really ineffective. I mean, the only real reduction in emissions was due to the collapse of the Soviet Union. Clinton signed that bill, but it was never ratified by the Senate, so it never came into force of law in the U.S. There's negotiations to create a successor agreement. There were hopes that it would really be much more robust than the Kyoto Protocol, that it would have science-based, mandatory, binding emissions targets for developed economies, that it would establish an international fund to transfer technology and capital to the global south to help those countries deal with adaptation and mitigation. And everybody was waiting for cues from the U.S., and the Obama administration ignored it. And the U.S. administrators, I wasn't there for it, but a good friend of mine, a couple of friends of mine covered it. Tina Gerhardt, who writes on these issues, was there for some of this. And the U.S. negotiators were very destructive, not helpful. Obama didn't use his power to make this serious. He only spent, I think it was, 8 hours in Copenhagen. So I forget what the question was, but that's... I think other countries, I mean, they were ready. Other countries were ready. If the largest, most technologically advanced country in the world was going to take this seriously, they would as well. But then they're like, what is this exactly? The oldest industrialized economies, the U.S., Britain, Europe, have created the problem historically. That most of the carbon has been produced by our economies. There's a responsibility, and you now want the emerging economies, the BRIC economies, to shoulder this burden when the U.S. is refusing to participate. That's not conducive to an agreement. So I wouldn't worry that if the U.S. got its house in order, what would we do about India and China? Already, China, to its credit, is investing aggressively in renewable technology, and that's partly due to local crises. Air pollution in urban China is so bad that there's a demand for clean power, not because of climate change, but because it's unbreathable much of the time in Beijing. The air quality index in the United States, if it goes, I think, above 50, but definitely if it goes to 100, there are warnings, don't go outside, smog alert, don't drive. Beijing goes months at a time where it's above 500. So people in China want coal plants shut down for that reason. And as a result, China is taking the lead and investing aggressively and adding lots of wind capacity and solar capacity, particularly wind.
And nuclear power after Japan?
It's, I think it is dead in the water for 10 years. There's been promise of an atomic renaissance, and it hasn't developed. The dangers of the technology are obvious with this disaster in Japan, but also a point that isn't made that often is that it's economically unfeasible. I mean, if you look at how expensive this technology is, how long it takes to build these plants, and what it would take to build enough of them to make a difference, you're talking about trillions of dollars and about 20 years. So let's say we could live with the risks, whatever. It simply doesn't make sense in terms of the time frame, in terms of the fact that we're up against this limit. We're at 390 parts per million. We don't have the time to do that. And that's a point that's the ultimate nail in the coffin, the last nail in the coffin for atomic power. But the discourse around it is, does several things. One, it buys time for fossil fuels. Because the more we talk about this technology, and typically the technology is talked about as technology, not as a social process, not as an economic question, but people will tell you about the design of these new reactors and blah, 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 blah. And then, when you start asking, and how much would they cost, and what procedures would it take, and how long would it take to site them, et cetera, the whole thing falls apart. So once the technology is placed within a social context, it's unfeasible. But the more we talk about it, the less we talk about the problem of fossil fuels. And the more we talk about new nukes and the future of nukes, the less we talk about the existing nukes, because the real issue, the real agenda of the atomic power sector is to relicense and uprate the 104 existing atomic plants in this country, half of which are leaking radioactive tritium, and half of which have been given 20-year extensions on their 40-year licenses. They're designed and licensed to last for 40 years. Radiation embrittles metal and concrete. They're supposed to be taken offline, and half of them have been given 20-year extensions on their life. Beyond that, many of them have been given what are called power uprates, and they're now running at 120% of their designed capacity. So that's the real agenda. While we're talking about could we or should we or what is the role of atomic power in the future, right now this industry, which also in many cases happily unburdened themselves of their previous debts onto the public sector, when deregulation collapsed and there was the power crisis in California, it was argued that the nuke plants had to be separated from their debts and resold to new companies, and that is how all the debts of their construction were shifted to the taxpayers. And you know who was essential in helping that happen was EDF and NRDC. Mark Dowie's book, American Foundations, has a chapter on the power crisis, and it's shocking what those big green groups did amidst that. So, you know, it's not the solution.
Well, throughout your book, you discuss the ways in which climate change has severely changed the monsoon season in India. It severely changed Africa. Here, we've seen tornadoes in the Midwest, and right now, there's an enormous drought and heat wave going on through the Southwest. Do you think that this is going to wake people up?
Hopefully, yeah. I mean,
it should.
Yeah. You know, despite all the investment by Exxon and the Koch brothers in pushing back against the awakening and concern around climate change, still, like 56% of people, according to the Pew polling agency, take climate change very seriously and are worried about it. That's a lot of people. You know, I mean, that's enough to have traction in progressive policy. So I think most people's minds are made up, and there's a sizable minority of denialists, but they're not the majority. They get the majority of time.
I think that's about.
That's about it for time.
We've been going a little bit. It's a little after nine now.
Okay. Well, thank you all.
Yeah.